Thank you, Maria, and good afternoon, and thank you all for joining us today. I'm Jack Herman, the Acting Director of ASPR's National Healthcare Preparedness Programs. And before I run through the agenda, I have a couple of brief announcements. As some of you may be aware, I stepped in as the Acting Director of the National Healthcare Preparedness Program in August of 2019, while we were conducting a national search for a new director. And while the COVID-19 response delayed the recruitment of that position, we have recently reposted the position, and the application process closes tomorrow. If you are interested in the position or you know someone who is, we're happy to provide the link to the posting in the chat box. At the end of this month, I'll be rotating back to my other ASPR job as the director of the Division of External Stakeholder Engagement. And just want to take this opportunity to express my sincere appreciation to the NHPP team, in particular, Jennifer Hanna, for all of her support and collegiality over the last 16 or 17 months that I've been in this role. I'm looking forward to returning to my other position, but also look forward to seeing who will be the new director and the new leadership of this very important and critical federal program. So let's move on now to today's call. During today's meeting, Jennifer Hanna will first share a few programmatic updates to you, and then we'll welcome Roger Severino, who's the director of the HHS Office of Civil Rights. Mr. Severino will discuss crisis standards of care, civil right issues that have emerged in the context of COVID-19. As background, also, ASPR was invited to join work with Johns Hopkins University's Center for Health Security, the American Association of Medical Colleges, and the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine to identify ways to raise the visibility of the need for our state and local partners, as well as healthcare systems and other private sector partners, to ensure that they have crisis standards of care guidelines and processes in place to help clinicians make difficult decisions at the bedside when faced with a resource-constrained environment, such as what we're seeing now. Towards this effort, this group has developed a call to action and a series of informational documents to help guide the healthcare and public health community in crisis standards of care decision-making. The HHS Office of Civil Rights has been instrumental in helping advise these resources. And we expect the resources will become available tomorrow. They're slated to be released by the National Academies at noon, and we'll be sure to provide you with the links in our weekly updates that come from our office. Finally, on today's call, we'll hear from Dr. Connie Price and Mara Prandi-Abrams, who will share insight into Denver Health's virtual hospital concept and approaches to address patient surge management. But before we begin the meeting, I want to ask a quick take a quick poll of this group, if you will entertain that. As rates of COVID-19 infection and deaths escalate across the country, the resultant surge on the nation's healthcare facilities is having significant impacts on frontline healthcare workers, resulting in worker fatigue, burnout, and concerns of shortages such as personal protective equipment. In addition to increasing the availability of PPE and addressing healthcare worker staffing shortages, what other actions or interventions may be taken by the U.S. government to reduce or mitigate these impacts? Some examples that have been raised so far are things like providing childcare opportunities or providing additional infection control training, expanding home health care options, or expanding eligible health care providers, such as utilizing EMS professionals at the top of their scope of practice. So we invite you now to type your responses in the chat box, or if you'd prefer to remain anonymous, feel free to click on the link in the chat box or cut and paste the URL into your browser. We'll take about 30 seconds or so for you to respond to the poll. And note that this is the same link that we provided in the healthcare readiness bulletin for those of you who received it, but is different from the registration question we asked you related to crisis standards of care. And we also encourage you, if you haven't taken that survey yet, to please do that, because that helps us better support your needs in regards to crisis standards of care. So just taking a few more seconds here to have you write in your responses. And again, feel free to keep jotting down your ideas, but we're very interested in trying to understand what, if anything, the government can do to help relieve that pressure on the front lines and address some of the mental health issues and other challenges that frontline healthcare workers are dealing with. So now let me pass it over to Jennifer Hanna, and she'll share a few programmatic updates. Jennifer?
Thank you, Jack. And before I begin, I would like to take a moment to thank Jack for his leadership during this time, or his time as the acting NHPP director. We greatly appreciate the time that he has spent in NHPP. And although he is leaving us, he's not going far, and we look forward to continuing to work collaboratively with him. Just a few updates from me for today. So you all now should be receiving the Healthcare Readiness Bulletin, which generally comes out every Monday. It provides the latest information on upcoming meetings, cooperative agreement requirements, and healthcare-specific trainings and webinars offered by ASPR and our partners. As some of you may have seen, we sent a brief update to you recently regarding the rollout of the Cooperative Agreement Accountability and Management Platform, or CAMP, right before the Thanksgiving holiday. While we have you all on the phone, we wanted to provide you with a quick update. We are still working closely with the HHS Office of the Chief Information Officer to obtain necessary approvals to go live. This is a necessary step, and although it has moved slower than we would have hoped, we are confident we will get there. Once we've been given the green light, we are essentially ready to roll out the platform to you, and we will start with training sessions and office hours to familiarize you with the functionality. Key to this platform, of course, is the ability to report on performance measures. Once the platform is open, please be rest assured that you will have ample time to complete the required reporting. Please let us know if you have any questions or concerns about CAMP. You can send those questions to the HPP mailbox, hpp@hhs.gov. Again, I want to emphasize that you will have ample time to complete your mid-year report once the platform is live. I will now pass it over to Mr. Roger Severina from the HHS Office of Civil Rights.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be speaking with you today about one of the most important questions our country can be facing. What is life worth? Who decides who gets to live and who gets to die? At HHS, we've done everything in our power to make sure that hospitals have the resources they need so that they avoid having to face those tough questions. But we have to prepare for the worst in case it does happen. And we encourage states and hospitals to adopt crisis standards of care that provide the guidelines for these what-if scenarios if the time does come where resource allocation decisions have to be made. There's a lot of discretion where states operate in this area, but my office, the Office for Civil Rights, sets out the boundaries and the guidelines to make sure that nobody is left behind, that everybody gets a fair shot, that discrimination never has any place in these life and death decisions. Our civil rights are there to provide those guardrails because there's been an unfortunate history where the medical profession, especially on the topic of disability and age, has not given full solicitude to the most vulnerable members of our community. The office enforces Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the Age Discrimination Act, among others, to make sure that when the going gets tough, the most vulnerable do not get thrown overboard. And unfortunately, in some quarters, there is a utilitarian ethic and a temptation to try to reduce people to some composite measure of their worth, which will, by its very nature, discriminate against people with disabilities and older persons. We want to resist that temptation. When we face a crisis, such as this global pandemic, that is a time when we need to hold fast to our civil rights laws. Our civil rights laws are not suspended during a crisis. Whenever we forget our Constitution and our civil rights laws in times of emergency, things go badly. We end up regretting it as a country. And so far, we've been working very hard with states to make sure that whenever these decisions are made to adopt crisis standards of care, that the people who need the protection are protected. Give you one example. One state dusted off their crisis standards of care plans, and we discovered that they had not updated in quite some time, and they had a categorical exclusion for persons with, quote, profound mental retardation, so that they would be flatly ineligible for a ventilator in case of shortage. Now imagine that. What message does that send as a society to people with Down syndrome, for example, that your life is not even worth attempting to save so they could give a ventilator to somebody who's quote unquote more worthwhile? Thankfully, after our intervention, the state quickly dispensed with that archaic standard. And we've seen other states improve their standards, not just on categorical exclusions based on disability, but also deprioritization of persons based on disability and age. So I'm gonna walk you through just a few of the standards that we've picked up upon in review of the states who've been working collaboratively with us, so that you could get a sense of where the tripwires are and how you could address them. Categorical exclusions. Whenever you specifically mention a particular disability as a basis for distinction and a criterion for either exclusion from a particular life-saving care or deprioritization, you're running into dangerous territory. There are clinically relevant bases for determining who should be allocated a resource. Saving the maximum number of lives is a noble, laudable goal. You are not reduced to simple coin flips to determine who gets scarce resources. However, when you do make these choices, they have to be based on an individualized assessment. You treat each person as an equal with an equal shot. You don't reduce them to a category and then exclude. You must take an equal individualized assessment based on the best objective medical evidence of that person in that circumstance, given the circumstances. Second, do not rely on stereotypes. Do not rely on quality of life judgments, thinking, what is this person's life going to be like before, during, and after the treatment? Even if a person will have a difficult life, that's their life. Medical professionals should not be in a position of weighing the relative value of one life versus another based on their condition or their ability. So what standards can be used? We focus on short-term survivability to discharge from the hospital. So whatever their treatment or allocation of resources is, you're on safe ground if you focus on their odds and likelihood of survival to discharge. And you could use all sorts of tools for that decision-making. We've seen use of the MSOFA for sequential organ failure. Now, my office does not comment on whether or not that is the best tool or an appropriate tool for the medical indications or analysis or diagnostic of survival likelihoods. We're saying whatever tools are used cannot discriminate on the basis of age or disability. So if someone were to use an MSOFA, if it has a ranking order that includes something that has a disparate impact on disability, provide reasonable modification, auxiliary aids and supports for that person with a disability. So if you're doing an exam on cognitive ability, it's very different when somebody has difficulty with comprehension and eye tracking after they've had a traumatic head injury versus a person who has a long-term developmental disability. There are very different circumstances, and you have to make sure their tools can take into account those differences through reasonable modifications and taking into account auxiliary aids and support. There's a question of reallocation of resources. If somebody comes in with a ventilator that is a personal ventilator, They do not want to ever be in a position where they're afraid to go to the hospital because it might be taken away from them and given to somebody else from these impermissible measures I've said before. So being proactive and saying that reallocation of somebody's personal ventilator is not allowed is something that we encourage states to adopt. Additionally, resource intensity, as well as duration of need. People with disabilities need auxiliary aids and supports. Oftentimes they need reasonable modifications, older persons as well, people to assist them with communication. We want to make sure we don't discriminate because they have additional needs during, even during times of scarcity. So there are clear boundary lines on being, doing what we can to modify our policies and make accommodations so that persons with disability are put on an equal plane with people without. And resource intensity and duration of need is one where you start getting to difficult territory. And additionally, on advanced directives, if medical providers are pressuring advanced directives or making it a condition before they do treatment, that's putting people in a vulnerable state in an unfair position. So we also encourage states to specifically disavow pressuring people to accept advanced directives, especially during a triage as a way of triaging, because that puts people in an imbalance. We want transparency. Far better to have plans out there debated with the public where we have competing ideas of the public good come together than have it done under the table, left to the discretion of somebody on the ground. My sister is a paramedic nurse in an emergency room. She's in the thick of the battle. It'd be unfair to her to not provide proper guidance in these difficult life and death circumstances. There's a way that we could fulfill the goals of maximizing the number of lives saved without using impermissible criteria that discriminate against older persons and persons with disability, using that individualized method that uses medically relevant information based on the likelihood of survival. Those are the touchstones, and we've seen so many states and the national academies will come out with a report touching on these things. And if you're interested in any particular example, we recommend the state of Utah's crisis standard of care and the state of Oregon's principles on crisis standards of care. They're fantastic models. And my office for civil rights is open to provide any technical assistance to you on the ground who needs it. We're here to help to the extent we can, as fast as we can, because we're all in it together.
Great. Thank you so much, Roger. To everyone on the phone, you can please feel free to submit questions via written form in the chat, or if you'd like to ask a question live, feel free to click on the participants icon at the bottom of your screen and the raise hand button on the right-hand side. Looks like I don't see any questions that have come in just yet, but we might want to just give it one more minute.
And Maria, this is Jack. I just want to remind our State Hospital Association colleagues on the line, you know, as we look at what we are currently faced with across the country and in the increasing escalation of stress on hospital systems as a result of the spread of this virus, where ICU capacity is surging and other care delivery systems are becoming more and more stretched, we do encourage you to make us aware of particular challenges in your jurisdictions that are notable and things that we should be monitoring here at ASPR, as well as where there are implications around this issue of crisis standards of care. As we are looking at it now, you know, obviously we're looking at various first line defenses, if you will, such as the use of monoclonal antibody therapeutics as ways and methods to hopefully mitigate a community reaching that crisis standards of care line. But we recognize that communities across the country are dealing with this in a variety of different ways, and many communities are already facing having to make critical decisions on care delivery. So in order for us to maintain what is happening on the front line, we would just appreciate you, letting us know if there are specific concerns or issues that are going on in your jurisdiction and things that you believe the federal government can be doing to support those jurisdictions. I think there may be a couple questions there, Maria.
Yes, I did see a couple come through the chat. So the first question is, Roger, can you please repeat the states with good models for crisis care?
Utah, as well as Oregon, I think are the two best we've seen. We've reached resolutions with four states on the verge of a fifth and a sixth. And I think those are the two best models. When we've learned as we've gone through this crisis and speaking a lot with hospitals and medical professionals and civil rights advocates, a lot of it was complaint driven and the result of this interactive process over time. And I think Utah and Oregon are the best. And we can provide links for you as well. I'll try to track it down for the chat.
Wonderful, thank you. And it looks like Utah has dropped in a link to their crisis standards of care resources. And it was updated just as recently as yesterday. So that's available in the chat as well. Okay. Well, it doesn't look like any more questions have come in. So I think we can move on to our next presenter. Roger, thank you so much. So I will pass it over to Dr. Price and Mara to begin their presentation.
Great, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you.
Great. My name is Connie Savor Price. I am the Chief Medical Officer at Denver Health in Denver, Colorado. And I'm also an infectious diseases physician. Mara Prandy-Abrams and I wanted to present to you our approach to planning for a surge of COVID patients in our hospital. As part of that, a lot of creative solutions are needed, including things like innovations like virtual hospital at home. So we'll touch briefly on that. I found in my years of disaster planning that it's really nice to have a surge plan, but until you know exactly what you're in and what the special threat is with regard to emerging pathogens, it's really hard to do this up front. But I hope that some of the principles that we describe here might be useful in informing future models and planning for future emerging infectious diseases threats in hospitals going forward. So with that, I will turn it over to the real brains of this duo, which is Mara Prandy-Abrams, who is our operations manager of patient flow at Denver Health. So Mara.
Thank you, Connie. I'm here to talk a little bit about how we've approached it and what we've seen, what was different, I guess, in the first surge versus the second surge. So next slide, please. We'll talk a little bit about who we are, what we looked like before COVID, our spring surge in that virtual hospital at home, as well as our fall surge, and then share our surge plan. Next slide, please. So who we are, we're Denver's Safety Net Hospital. We are about 550 licensed beds. We're actually a full system that includes our hospital, primary specialty care, multiple urgent cares, behavioral health, Denver Public Health, school-based health centers, Rocky Mountain Poison Drug Safety, medical. We've got a specific medical plan, and then we're also the 911 EMS system. And a high percentage of our patients are Medicaid, so we definitely treat that population as a majority. Next slide, please. So pre-COVID, we had about 227 adult med-surg critical care, which was split out about 47 ICU and 12 intermediate care, remaining obviously med-surg. And then, you know, the rest of our licensed beds were things like psych. We've got, we treat our correctional care facility. We've got women's and children and various things like that, and eating disorder clinic and things of that nature. We do have, or did have, frequent adult ED boarding, and we did typically have capacity in our women's and children's pavilion. Next slide, please. So in the spring, we definitely saw a large number of sick COVID patients, as I imagine much of the country did, but we did still have overall capacity in our hospital because we weren't seeing the typical patients that were coming in to our hospital before that. People definitely took notice to stay home. As part of that surge, we took some multiple of our existing med surge units and we added that ICU infrastructure so that we could really increase our ICU capacity by quite a lot. We did also convert a unit that had been sort of half, maybe not half, about a third was intermediate care and about two thirds was med surge care. And we created a kind of a flexible unit, which allowed us to flex up and down based on what the need was, whether that was floor care, intermediate, or critical care on that unit. We did consolidate some of our lower census pediatric units, which really gave us more beds that we could leverage for that adult population that we were seeing in quite high numbers. We developed a surge plan specific to this crisis, and we also created this virtual hospital at home program, which I'll go into more detail on. Next slide, please. So let's talk a little bit about the virtual hospital at home. Ultimately, the goal was how do we not hospitalize patients that were higher risk that had COVID-19 to really make sure we reserved our hospital capacity for those who really needed it and met criteria. In addition, we hoped to be able to discharge our patients with COVID so that we could reduce their length of stay and really open up those hospital beds for other patients. And so this allowed us to have that quick transition of those patients out of our hospital. And then we also, it was an extra level of safety for those patients who were enrolled in the program to make sure that if they were decompensating, we could quickly catch that and get them to the next level of care, that higher level of care that they needed. The criteria for that program has really changed as we've had or not had as much hospital bed capacity. So initially, it was really just one or more risk factors for decompensation, and now the criteria has increased to two or more risk factors, but we can really handle that mild hypoxia outside of the hospital. And really the program was focused on how do we use our outpatient providers, so providers, nurses, care navigators, to monitor patients at home. So patients were given a pulse ox, blood pressure cuff, and thermometer, and they would receive two calls daily, typically one from the provider and one from the nurse, to really check in on how those vital signs were going at home, any concerns in terms of what they were experiencing and things of that nature. Patients would be monitored through that usual time frame of what decompensation, when that would happen, and really monitor for that improvement or not. Patients were provided education, meal assistance, supplemental oxygen as needed, and then ultimately patients experiencing decompensation, we could arrange for them to be transported to the hospital so that they didn't really have to worry about anything. We could focus on just getting them to the hospital to get well. And now as part of our second surge, what we call Bam Bam and Dimexacetone, I can't even say that, for patients who meet that criteria, they're receiving that as well. Next slide, please. So capacity in our virtual hospital home and the results there, ultimately, like I said before, we really flex staffing to meet the demand. So it's been about 30 to 35 patients daily, but we've had as many as 45. And if we need to, we can actually increase even more. We have had, because of the fact that it's been such a popular program, we've had to downgrade some of those lower risk patients to less intensive monitoring to really allow our providers and nurses to focus on those that are a little bit higher risk. As of yesterday, we've seen 1,000 patients in the program, an average duration in the program about 4 days. For the initial analysis that was done during that spring surge of 228 patients, only about 13% required care escalation, and those that did require it, about 34% of those were admitted to the hospital. And the patient feedback has been very, very positive as well. And a huge shout out to the folks down at the bottom there, Stacey Altman and Dr. Ryan, as well as Dr. Hanratty, who really put this program together. And it's been a huge success in our hospital. Next slide, please. So in the fall, it's been a really different set of patients that we've seen. So while we've seen that increase in COVID patients, we've also seen a pretty large increase in our non-COVID patients. So overall, our hospital capacity has been much, much fuller. We did go ahead and permanently convert some of those units that we had capitalized on from our women's and children's unit in the spring to increase our adult capacity. And then in addition, we privileged pediatricians so that they could treat patients up to age 30, which really allowed us some flexibility when the hospital was fuller so that we could treat our older adults on our adult units. In addition, the availability of having those heated high flow oxygen has made it so that we could offload our ICU and allow our respiratory therapists to treat more patients on our floor units instead of in the ICU. And then, as always, you know, the greatest plans, laid plans, you have to change oftentimes. And so our surge plan tended to have larger increments in terms of how many beds we increased at each level. And we learned that that really was not feasible. And ultimately, we didn't need it. We didn't need to increase by 40 to 50 beds at a time. And so we worked to really break down our surge into smaller levels, both to make it more easier to move up levels, as well as to allow for recruiting staff to keep up with that. A lot of that staff, as I imagine many people are experiencing, is hard to find. And so we're using a lot of that temporary staff. And then what was great was we had our surge plan ready to go. And so when we received an executive order from our Colorado governor to increase capacity by 50%, we were able to quickly respond to that and use both our hospital capacity as well as our virtual hospital home capacity as part of that response to that executive order. Next slide. And so it's a little bit hard to see, but this is our surge plan. And you can see sort of that level one was where we were pre-COVID. And then level two is really where we were in the spring. And so each level as we go up allows us to increase capacity, doubling beds in certain rooms, increasing both ICU and med-surge capacity frequently at different levels to make sure that we don't have too much of one versus the other. And a lot of what we've learned is really that having hybrid units that can treat COVID positive and negative patients has been very helpful depending on where we are within the particular surge. And that's all I have, if there are any questions.
Thank you so much, Mara. I'm monitoring the chat to see if any questions come in. As a reminder, feel free to send your written questions via the chat, or you can also ask the question verbally by raising your hand.
I guess I'll ask a question of the audience. I'm curious how many of you also have a virtual hospital at home or similar construct? Either a very shy group or we're pretty novel.
Yeah, it looks like some in the chat box saying not at this time in Kansas. Do you know other folks have maybe slight variations of this or? And again, feel free to take yourselves, raise your hand and happy to have you participate on the screen.
Yeah, I think I have heard of some other Colorado hospitals that have done something similar. Honestly, I think the barrier has been in reimbursement because it isn't well reimbursed right now. And so there isn't, you know, you do get paid better to put the patients in the hospital. That said, when we're in the middle of a pandemic and we are even talking about scary issues like crisis standards of care because we don't have hospital beds available, I think as a healthcare system, we all need to get more creative and try to get around those barriers of reimbursement in just doing the right thing. So perhaps we'll see some movement on that in future healthcare models, that this won't be a costly intervention for most, because it was very effective, both from a patient satisfaction issue as well as from a care issue.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Price. Yeah, just looking in the chat now, it looks like there may be, you know, some facilities like in Utah, Idaho, New Mexico, you know, that might be looking at variations of this. But I think, again, this is in the context of what we're currently dealing with and what we're projecting to see over the next weeks and months in regards to surge on hospitals. There are concepts like these and models like these that I think are going to be instrumental to communities at being able to address the patient care delivery services in the context of these constrained resources, you know, and we're going to see that likely continue for the next weeks and months, given where we're at now with this pandemic, and encourage you all to, you know, be looking for these kinds of resources, making sure that you're connecting with us if there are things that we can be of assistance with, or resources and tools that we can be sharing with you, and in turn, you sharing with your members. Please do not hesitate to let us know.
Thank you.
I want to jump back to one issue, and I'm not sure if Mr. Severino is still on the line, but one of the, you were promoting the, hi, Roger. You were promoting the Utah and, sorry, I just drew a blank, the other facility, or the other state crisis standard of care plan. Oh, you're on.
Utah and Oregon.
Oregon, thank you. So one of the questions, because I think you had probably meant this, but I may have got lost in translation there. So describing them as exemplary plans, you're talking about the perspective of their inclusion of provisions to address civil rights, as opposed to kind of looking at the whole plan and every element within the plan as an exemplar.
Precisely.
Okay.
When I mentioned, for example, the discussion of MSOFA, it's not whether or not it's clinically appropriate. That's a judgment for the doctors to decide. It's whether or not, if it's used, is there proper accommodations and taking into account of civil rights laws? So when I refer to Utah and Oregon, I've sent a link to Utah's in the chat box. It's for their civil rights compliance and best practices. They go, they're great in saying that if you use X, Y, and Z tools, this is how you do it in a way that does not discriminate. It doesn't use age cutoffs. It doesn't use categorical calling out of disabilities, and it says you should not use things like reallocation or long-term duration. So it has green lights, yellow lights, and red lights. Green lights, what you should do. Yellow lights, how, if you apply it, how you should modify it and make accommodations. And red lights, you should not do X. And that's why, from a civil rights perspective and a civil rights perspective only, we think there are models.
So I think, and I appreciate that clarification, because I think this is one of the issues we're going to be challenged with again over the coming months as states and jurisdictions and healthcare systems begin to either develop their plans or refine their plans. Because of what they're encountering in real time, they're going to need to be able to make real-time changes and updates, and they're going to need to know what subject matter experts that they can reach out to for consultation or consideration. And certainly from the perspective of civil rights, they can always reach out to the HHS Office of Civil Rights for any assistance or support they may need in helping refine, update, modify those particular components of their plan to ensure that they are respecting civil rights. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. So for example, we say there should be individualized assessments of each patient using the best available medical evidence. We don't opine as to what actually counts as the best. That's the expertise of you all to figure out what is the best evidence for the clinical presentation and if you're going to use discharge, survivability to discharge. So that's, you know, there's different spheres of expertise, and we're happy to provide any assistance for anybody on the line if you want to know more of how civil rights laws could apply with whatever tool you may be considering adopting.
Great, thank you. And also, as we try to connect with the patient, surge management issues as well is drawing people's attention to Asper Tracy for the many, many resources that Asper Tracy has available to you and your members in regards to resources to address surge management issues. And, you know, we have obviously great relationships with our partners, including our Denver partners, who can help, you know, answer questions or lead you to other particular resources that you or your members may need as you all begin to, you know, continue down this path of facing the very real challenges that this pandemic is bringing to the front line every day. Let me just stop and see if Mara or Connie have any additional comments or feedback or even posing other questions to the group. Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Let me now, if I can, open it up. We'll just take a few minutes here and ask our state hospital association partners, are there any other topic areas that you would like to either raise on this call or have us consider for future calls? What are the things that are most impacting your members throughout your states, or you as a program office, if you will, administering the funding, the COVID supplemental funding that Asper has provided you? Looking in the chat box here, staffing strategies for surge. Excellent topic. Any others? Delays in discharge for long-term care patients. Staffing resources for critical care. More frequently asked questions for addressing vaccination. We'll add that to the list. Anyone think that considerations for telemedicine in the vaccine implementation strategy or the role of telemedicine in vaccine implementation? Just kind of throwing that out.
At a pitch.
Sure.
Back on telemedicine. So my office also regulates HIPAA, which you all know and love. We issued a notice of enforcement discretion earlier this year, allowing use of common telecommunication apps, mm-hmm. FaceTime, Zoom, WebEx, any typical like Skype type application can be used for telemedicine now, and we will not enforce any related HIPAA violation that comes from use of that particular device. Normally you would need a business associate agreement and a few other things. And I think that's helped revolutionize a shift towards telemedicine that will still continue through vaccination. You could use your phone to talk to your patients. If you weren't aware of that, please take full advantage. If your patients are comfortable using their iPhone to communicate remotely, they should be able to with you, and don't worry about HIPAA enforcement as it. And we're actually looking for ways to make that sort of communication permanent, because we believe there's enough privacy with the end-to-end encryption that it may fall under an exception. But so please be aware that you could use that right now.
Great, thank you. So, you know, and looking in the chat, see a number of responses related to staffing shortages, and I'll challenge folks to try to be as in the weeds as possible if there are specific areas to address within staff shortages, as specific as you can be, you know, please let us know, and you can submit any of these questions or refinements to your topic areas at our email address at hpp@hhs.gov. And as I said, we can look at how to add these topic areas to future calls or set up actually ad hoc calls if we see there's enough interest in these topic areas. But I'm taking away from this that obviously more discussion or information on the vaccine implementation strategy, how to address and resolve staffing shortages. And again, as much definition to that question as you can provide me would be appreciated. And it looks like we've, you know, got a few others on here as well, especially around potentially risk communication and public messaging around mask mandates and issues related to that. Great. Well, again, we appreciate your time today, and also want to thank our presenters for the great presentations that you provided to us this afternoon. As I mentioned, we'll continue to monitor any challenges or other issues that you bring to our attention. We want to encourage you to share your stories or those of your members by emailing us at hpp@hhs.gov. Also want to remind you that if you've not taken any of the surveys, we sent you the links out earlier in the chat box, would appreciate your input and feedback on that. You know, as I mentioned at the top of the call, our priorities right now are to look at ways that we can help reduce the surge on healthcare systems and the stressors on healthcare systems that we're seeing related to the increasing, pandemic. And want to make sure that we remain open to hearing what challenges you and your members are facing, and are there opportunities for the U.S. government to help alleviate or mitigate some of those. Our efforts over the next couple weeks are going to be focused on raising the visibility on the use of monoclonal antibody therapeutics as a way, hopefully, to mitigate or prevent patients from needing hospitalization or reaching the ICU, as well as making sure that states and local jurisdictions and healthcare systems are putting together the necessary actions related to crisis standards of care. So you'll see us emphasize that over the next few weeks and months as we deal with the stress on the frontline healthcare systems. So again, thank you all for joining us today, and we'll end 10 minutes early and appreciate your time. Take care, everyone.